Today's episode is the first of our mini-series on the Tudor dynasty. I've discovered something when I'm using the word processor on my computer or when I'm using predictive text on my smartphone, which is that when I write Henry VII with Roman numerals, it auto-corrects to Henry VIII. The same thing happens when I type Henry VII into an internet search engine. There's an assumption that I must be thinking about Henry VIII, which I often am, but not at that particular point in time. What is going on? There's also the fact that television follows a similar trajectory. It's not been since 1972, over 50 years ago, that there has been a small or a big screen focus on the founder of the Tudor dynasty. Unlike his son, Henry VII seems to attract very little attention in the popular imagination. And yet, as I hope today's episode will show, we ignore Henry VII at our peril. How did this usurper successfully consolidate his throne? How did he face off repeated threats to his power? What type of person was he? And how did he get along with others? And what sort of legacy did he leave? To reveal all, I am very pleased to welcome back to Not Just the Tudors, Dr. Sean Cunningham, Head of Medieval Records at the National Archives in London. He is a Fellow of the Royal Historical Society and author of many works on the late medieval era, including his biography, Henry VII. Dr. Sean Cunningham, welcome back to Not Just the Tudors.
Thank you very much, Susanna. I'm really pleased to be here.
It is a really good thing to have a chance to talk in some depth about Henry VII, because there is a sense that people sometimes feel like the Tudor dynasty started a generation later, and we need to make sure that we have a good record of him. And the other thing I think is also so important is that if we think of him at all, it tends to be of a kind of picture of a miser and someone who's secret and sober and, you know, the sort of real sense of that avarice and parsimoniousness and all that sort of stuff, which may be true in the later years of his reign, but there's a lot more to the story than that. So I'm hoping that we're going to really have a bit of a corrective today.
I think that's really important because it is a reign of calamity and threats. There's really no still moments other than a couple of two-year periods where either the threats from plotters or pretenders or the kind of collapse of the money supply and the way kings are supposed to behave always seems to be under threat with Henry. And it's a real transitional period between what was quite a lengthy few decades of civil war right back to Henry IV's reign, right into the Tudors, which are perhaps more familiar. I think Henry's reign is putting a stop to some of the practices that had gone before, his view of what was necessary, and then setting the scene out for a more stable Tudor dynasty to take power after him. So he's almost resolving a lot of the issues, sacrificing some of the normal pleasures of kingship in order to stabilize the ship of state again, to allow his heir to take that forward. It's just not the heir he thought it would be.
No, and we'll come to that. But let's start with getting a sense of who Henry, Earl of Richmond, later King Henry VII, was. Can you give us some of the sort of things we need to know about his background and upbringing, and tell us why he had a claim to the throne?
Yes, it's a really interesting patchwork of descent and ancestry. On his father's side is to Wales and North Wales and the Tudor family, as they were later known, but obviously being Welsh landowners. The connection to the royal family in England comes from his mother, Margaret Beaufort, her links back to John of Gaunt and Edward III. Although they were legitimised, they were still a very prominent courtly family, very powerful individuals, very strong role in the Wars of the Roses. And also Margaret has a lot of other relatives who are still around, like the Wells family, the Zouches, and there's various gentry families who are very much in the kind of middle seam of society to which Henry is connected. And he's also got a link to Henry VI through his grandfather, Queen Tudor's marriage, Catherine of Valois, Henry V's widow, and that gives Jasper and Edmund Tudor, Henry's uncle and father, a half-blood link to Henry VI, which does get picked up in the sort of 1470 stages of the Wars of the Roses. So it gives Henry a kind of connection which is indistinct, which doesn't really stand out in the men of whom, like the Staffords, Buckingham family, have got stronger connections to other sons of Edward III, And the York family and the marriages of Edward IV, Richard III's sisters, create another alliance of descent which set up male figures who potentially have equal, if not stronger, claims to Henry. And even people like Catherine of Aragon, through their ancestry, have a connection to the Lancastrian and the Plantagenet dynasty, at least equal to Henry's if you take those steps backwards. He's not really claiming the throne for a lot of his early years. He's not a candidate. There isn't really an opportunity because until Edward IV dies in April 1483, the future of the Yorkist dynasty looks fairly stable. There's a teenage heir who everyone seems to be backing. There seems to be an end to the kind of squabbling which had brought people to the battlefield in the 1460s. That seems to have been contained by Edward IV. Henry, in 1470-71, has to flee overseas because his uncle Jasper Tudor is the last stalwart of Lancastrian resistance to Edward IV. And is removed or removes himself after the battles of Barnet and Tewkesbury and takes young Henry with him, who's only a teenager, or even a teenager by then, born in 1457, he's about 13. So Henry goes off to live in Brittany as a kind of roving guest of the Dukes of Brittany, a bit of a pawn for politics to be used in diplomatic negotiations to get some leverage from the Yorkists over Brittany linked to trade and piracy and their relationship with France. Henry's not a really important figure for much of Edward IV's reign. That moment in 1483, which transforms it all, when suddenly Edward V is removed from his opportunity to rule, which if Duke of Gloucester becomes Richard III, things really do turn upside down very quickly. And in amongst that chaos, Henry Tudor is put forward as somebody around whom people can collect and gather, and a very quick kind of sidestep puts him into prominence as a candidate for the throne. So that's when people begin to look at his ancestry, his credentials, which do seem weak on paper, but in the cold light of the practicalities of resisting Richard III, the people who had supported Prince Edward V, who Richard had displaced, they want to get restoration to their estates and whatever power they had through Edward IV's royal household. And Henry's growing plot based in Brittany and later in France is the only vehicle through which they have a chance of recovering whatever power and links they had. So Henry's kind of thrust forward from within this group to be almost a disposable figurehead. I think people like Henry Stafford are hovering in the background as possible claimants because of their Stafford lines back to Edward III's sons. So Henry might have been moved aside had things not gone as they did, and maybe opportunities had arisen for other people to step into the limelight as that plot had moved forward. But we also have to consider Margaret Beaufort is really pulling the strings in this. There's a lot of factors which come together, which we probably didn't expect, but at some point he switches on to this kingly role in waiting and really begins to focus himself and his friends towards claiming the throne, but then how do we actually rule a country from this starting point of little experience, disconnection, loaned allegiance, temporary friends. He's got a very difficult task to move from the shadows of Brittany, where we really don't know much about him and what he's doing in the 1470s, into this role of king-in-waiting and direct challenger to Richard III, and credible challenger as well. It's amazing that he actually got to that point, because if everything else had worked, he would have just disappeared into obscurity fairly quickly.
So when he becomes king in 1485, he's grown up in Wales. He spent 14 years, one could argue, as a sort of captive in exile in Brittany. He's only briefly been to England. He doesn't have a training as a prince. He hasn't got experience of governing. He hasn't got wealth or land. I mean, he has some backers in the end, but he seems particularly ill-poised to become king. He must therefore have been a very impressive person, especially if there was a sense that he was a potentially disposable leader, as you've suggested. And you really convey in your work that he's a complex and nuanced figure. But you say we don't have that much archival evidence at this early stage. When do we first start to see these kind of traits in him that will equip him for leadership? And what do we see of his character then that we also see throughout his life?
We see some of it reflected in the way Richard III picks up on the threat and his denouncements and proclamations against the Tudor conspiracy and the leaders of that. So he's categorising and characterising Henry in a certain way as a foreign puppet who will bring the end to the English way of doing things and introduce all of these foreign traits to ruling, which is designed to stir up opposition against him. So we begin to get a sense of Henry through not what he is, but what other people say he is, but in a very negative way. And I think that period is also important because we begin to see him galvanising a very varied range of backers. Old Lancastrians like the Earl of Oxford, who's been in prison since 1471, others who removed themselves from England, like the Marquess of Dorset, the Grey family, again, possibly thinking of their best move, their best opportunity to get back to a position of power, almost riding along as this vehicle gains momentum. So Henry's abilities begin to shine through at this stage because he's negotiating with these people one to one. He's trying to convince them not only that he's capable of being king in their interests, but also ruling the country and what's required as a ruler of the body politic. So his knowledge of what England needs as a ruler has come from some form of learning, some form of observance of the Breton and French courts at first hand. I think he's become a very shrewd maneuverer of politics. He's managed to evade attempted kidnapping. He's managed to flee just in time to evolve court plots in Brittany, giving him up to Edward IV and Richard III. He learns political action quite quickly as a self-survival kind of mode of operating. And that translates a little bit into his first years as king when he's really facing an instant threat to depose him. But in that period of working up to the Battle of Bosworth, he's doing things which we see in chroniclers like Polydore Vergil writing later, offering a narrative of how things had come about. And there is some evidence that the kind of letters he'd been writing to attract support. I think there's an awful lot which is unrecorded and unrecordable because naturally a conspiracy is not something you're going to write down. So some of the letters, some of the journeys of people like Margaret Beaufort's coterie of religious acolytes like Christopher Urswick, state steward Reginald Bray, various people who become prominent in the early Tudor period, but are really people who Margaret Beaufort has brought forward from her estates at Woking and her connection to the Stanleys in Lancashire, they are an automatically core group of supporters that really work hard for Henry. And then he adds this Yorkist experience in as well. And long conversations with people like John Morton, who's been Bishop of Ely under Edward IV, Richard III. He's got great experience of administrative change, managing the exchequer, looking at how government works in its intricate details. It's the sort of thing Henry likes because he can see the value in learning the whole picture, the framework of things, how the mechanism of ruling works. As you say, he's never even managed a set of estates before. He's not got the usual experience of a minor gentleman, never mind an earl or a duke, to actually learn how you command people, how you look after your own money, how you position yourself in the political world locally, but also how you link to the centre, how you navigate all these things as a real spider's web of influences and risks. So he has to do this fleet-footed inside a conspiracy where he's learning these skills as a communicator, as a leader, as someone with vision and an idea or a sense of strategy. All this is coming together as his plot is having to progress because he realizes, having been thrown into this thing with Richard III and taking the throne ahead of Edward V, there's now a real polarization with the Woodville group and the old Edwardian Yorkist connection, wanting to see Richard III deposed for that change of regime, which was unexpected and unplanned. So a lot of them thought unwarranted. So the rebellion to try and get the princes out of the Tower in June or July 1483, and then the Autumn Rebellion of 1483, where Henry makes his first appearance as a leader, coming in a bit too late to make any difference because of bad weather and poor organization. But by then, he's got a flotilla, he's got Breton backing. He seems to have a set of skills which at least have convinced this set of people that he is the person to lead that initial challenge to Richard. Whether they would have saw that as a long-term thing without any evidence of him actually being a ruler, it's difficult to say. And people must have seen some characteristics in him which, in that group of allies, didn't cause them to push him aside, to think about somebody else who had a stronger English ancestry, which sat more centrally in the kind of court politics of the later medieval period. Thinking about Lancastrian and Yorkist imbalance from the sort of 1450s onwards, you certainly wouldn't have had Henry Tudor as a person who fitted that bill as a conciliatory character or as a galvanizing or unifying figure. He's perpetuating the dislocation and the infighting and some of the feuding, which really flared up very quickly when Edward IV died. But I think in the course of that, he's transformed himself almost into a figurehead of real power, real strength. And people believed in him, clearly. He should never have got to the battlefield of Bosworth. And then he shouldn't really have had a chance of winning it because Richard's army was two or three times bigger. You can see the uncertainty playing out in real time on the battlefield, all of which played into Henry's hands as obviously the person who will be taking up the reins of power if Richard is defeated. And I think he's taken a lot of advice from people who've been through the politics of the 1460s and 70s. He's almost got a blueprint of what he wants to do to get to that point of being king, but then the hard work really starts.
Right, exactly. So he becomes king after defeating Richard III at the Battle of Bosworth. But as you say, that's when the hard work starts. And in schools, students to this day debate how Henry consolidated his authority after Bosworth. So, Sean, what factors enabled Henry to consolidate his authority after Bosworth?
I think the fact that it had been another round of civil war, another period where people are having to make choices about whether they stick or twist, whichever way the circumstances, their local allegiances, local communities were going, how their lord was reacting. So everyone would have to have made some element of choice like this about whether they try and lock the door and hide from the reality of what's happening, or do they take up their shield and sword and ride off to join one side or another. So that causes an awful lot of weariness about conflict, having to make a choice, having to potentially throw the country back into civil war once more. So that's an advantage for Henry. He can present himself as a blank canvas, somebody who has got obviously some skin in the game in terms of becoming king, but he's not somebody with direct baggage personally. He relies on that marriage proposal to Elizabeth of York to keep those Yorkists on side, and then that funnels into the future heir they will have together, but that's all a wish list item at that stage. So he makes those noises, he makes those proclamations, this is what I want to do. This sets out how people can come together under this Tudor leader. He does a little bit of kind of myth investigation to show the long connection to British rulers, and this idea of a uniting king, King Arthur kind of mythology is put forward, which is interesting as a position from which to argue about rights and legitimacy. But ultimately, killing your opponent on the battlefield at least gives you enough breathing space to put the crown on your head and show what you can do. So that's the first thing which people allow him. Most people allow him a year or 18 months to fulfill some of his promises, to establish some sort of government which is getting control of things. Because Richard had been up in Nottingham for 3 months or so before Bosworth, there was a conspiracy to undermine some of the means of communication and the ways of getting money to people who were on the kind of front line of defense in stewarding castles or were responsible for raising the militia in different parts of the country. So they neutered Richard's kind of capacity to defend the whole country. So the machinery of government had broken down a little bit. Henry can come in barely with enough shirts on his back. One of the first things he does before he even reaches London is send on ahead for 12 new shirts to be made, because he's literally in his campaign clothes and won't look like a king when he gets to the Bishopsgate and sort of starts to present himself as the monarch who's going to solve all the problems of the country. He needs to look like a king and start behaving like a king. People give him that chance, and I think we see enough of a gap before the conspiracies start. It really is the spring of 1486 before we start to see rebels getting their act together to try and coordinate something. So he has about 9 months or so, maybe slightly less, to begin to do things. And he says, I'm a king who knows little about this realm, and I won't abrogate any of its customs. I won't try and change anything. I'm going to fall into the pattern of medieval kingship you expect. I'm not bringing those foreign traits to bear on England. I need to learn from you all, because you've all been here. I'm a king who really has your interests at heart. I'm not trying to change anything. And he goes back to the traditional ways of doing things through things like the exchequer, raising the revenue, negotiating in a very traditional way for the payments to the royal household. He's not trying to inflate his bank account and his coffers. He's trying to restart government in a traditional way to see if that works in the terms which work for his kingship. Obviously, it doesn't work as he wants, because the threat and the plot start straight away. So he has to start responding and changing to strengthen his personal position. And that's when we begin to see some thinking with government ways of doing things, with selecting friends for appointments, with trying to really second guess how people are going to jump, whether they're going to stick to the legacy of Richard III's plotting, because Bosworth had only really destroyed Richard and his household friends. Maybe 20,000 soldiers in Richard's army just simply turned around and went home again under the Earl of Northumberland, all those northerners that Richard was famous for leading in 1482 into Scotland, and how he galvanized them were supporting in the 1470s, they hadn't really been able to make a decision on the battlefield. So Henry has to negotiate and navigate that allegiance, sell himself to them as a king who can really work for the whole country. And they want to see what happens. So I think it's an advantage not having people know what your background is, what your kind of blueprint already looks like, because to some extent, it's quite difficult for people to set aside their ancestry, their experience of being a lord or a lady, running people, running the law, and all of those things which kind of constituted a senior figure in late medieval England. Henry has none of that. So it looks like a weakness, but it's actually possibly a strength in that early moment. And then those other skills which he'd already developed of personal leadership, the convincing orator, the skilled bureaucrat, basically, he's into the detail. And he masters all that detail so he cannot be gainsaid about anything to do with running the country. He basically very quickly learns the processes. So he has to become the filter for everything which happens because he wants to have control and say yes or no to these things. So even down to appointing the grooms of the kitchen, he's basically looking to see how they fit into his pattern, as well as the new set of sheriffs. That's probably why he doesn't promote many new lords into the higher peerage. Not until his coronation, anyway. But then it's his uncle, Duke of Bedford, Jasper Tudor. It's Lord Stanley becomes Earl of Derby. He rewards people who have made a real difference, but he's not dangerously generous with his patronage. He's taking it a step at a time and he's reacting to that messaging coming back from the country, whether they really do believe he should be king. So it's a very incremental step through the traditional ways of ruling, but at the same time, there's a sort of parallel idea forming about really ideal. Early Tudor set of government machinery is going to be set up. And by 1487, he's beginning to put his own stamp on that traditional machinery. And we then begin to see things taking off quite quickly.
One of the things that seems unfair about the way we remember Henry VII is, despite the fact that he won his crown on the battlefield and then spent most of his reign running around all over the place defending that throne, that doesn't seem to be a central part of how people see him as a warrior king. But in practice, he faces many attempts to dethrone him by these so-called pretenders. And could you briefly give us a sense of these actual and potential threats to his throne? And also, can you explain one slightly mysterious thing, his relatively merciful treatment that he shows towards the perpetrators?
Most of the threats come quite early in that Richard III's sister, Margaret of York, Dowager Duchess of Burgundy, is coordinating things almost immediately. So she is trying to basically repeat what Henry had done to her brother Richard by collating a mercenary army, supplying it with money and ships, and giving it a means to get into England and challenge the king on the battlefield as soon as possible before Henry has a chance to consolidate his rule and begin to acquire those real skills, which she probably knew he had because that amazing achievement of gaining the throne sent such a strong message of this is a really amazing individual. He's facing that kind of relentless challenge. And there is an awful lot of people in the north and perhaps in the West Midlands, which is where the first threats come, who want to really stir things up. And there's a couple of attempts to have a sort of direct challenge. They never really have a go at a household plot in 1487, which is snuffed out at the time Parliament meets just before Elizabeth of York is crowned queen, which is a story in itself. Why didn't he marry her first and then be crowned together? Very interesting dynamics about the politics of using the queen's connection as a real pillar for the Tudor power. He
Well,
kind of,
why is that? What's the purpose there?
I think some of it is he obviously has to have his own power consolidated or his own power reinforced by the power of the coronation ceremony. And that has to be a personal power. So it's God's investment of divine power in him as an individual. But obviously, the politics of it is all based on that relationship with the Yorkist exiles from 1483, whom, because the princes in the Tower are dead, Elizabeth of York is the last heir or the eldest heir of York. She has plenty of sisters. Also married to the De la Poles or the Courtenays. So that sense of reliance on another group, which obviously supports the claim that Elizabeth would have had in her own right to be a queen regnant at that moment, doesn't really get into the picture. She foregoes that claim to back her husband, which again moves people slightly more to the centre. But it does leave these outliers who are very willing to carry on plotting. It's Humphrey Stafford, and it's Francis Lord Lovell initially. Richard III's childhood friends, you can understand why they would really activate the kind of plot. And that disappears quickly. There's another plot in 1487, which comes out of Ireland, with the Fitzgerald family sending an Irish army to match with a mercenary army sent from the Low Countries by Margaret of Burgundy, which is a really impressive German army of top quality soldiers who fight at the Battle of Stoke. Again, almost a rerun and blueprint of Bosworth, but Henry survives that by relying on the Earl of Oxford again and doesn't really have to commit a lot of forces to risk that battlefield isolation that Richard III, his frustrations at the course of the battle caused him to make this cavalry charge and isolate himself. Henry watches a lot of it from the Tower of Newark Church, doesn't actually go onto the battlefield. And so that's 1487, getting through that real threat of of being required to fight another battle, I think, is a major achievement, which again makes people realize he's a king that has staying power. Just before then, he's obviously had his heir, Prince Arthur, born at Winchester in this fanfare of kind of Arthurian myth and the fulfillment of Arthur, certainly intending to, or hopefully fulfilling this once and forever king kind of idea in his own life to come after Henry VII as the next Tudor king. So there's investment in the future already being built into the politics of the present. And in that sense, all of these threats, the longer they go on as Arthur is there being developed as a future king, the weaker they get in a way. So when there's a tax rebellion in Yorkshire, which again has overtones of, I guess, the reaction to Bosworth, so the Earl of Northumberland is killed, allegedly for not supporting Richard III on the battlefield, which requires another army to go into the north. York is open to the rebels and is almost captured, but again, it's a bit of a damp squib in the face of a large southern army coming up from with the king in person. And after that, it changes tack, really. 1487 was one pretender, Lambert Simnel, created as Edward, Earl of Warwick, who was still alive. He was, I suppose, the last male Yorkist candidate with really good blood connections. He's the son of Edward IV, Richard III's other brother, George, Duke of Clarence. So he has a direct link to that claim, which Henry is hovering over, not quite sure what to do with him. He's locked up fairly quickly after 1485, occasionally brought out, but spends most of the rest of his life in prison to die on the scaffold in 1499 alongside another pretender, Perkin Warbeck. And this is the real threat to Henry, because this plot after 1491 goes directly to that relationship between the Tudor king and his Yorkist supporters, in the hope that Prince Arthur will bring all of these ancestries and claims together in a very stable and secure figurehead who everyone can back. So they're saying, no, Prince Richard, well, the youngest of the princes in the Tower, survived, which negates Elizabeth of York's claim to be the funnel through which all this Yorkist allegiance can go. A male heir suddenly back on the scene is designed to turn heads. And in a way, it doesn't really matter if it's true. It's what people believe to be true and their actions based on that, which would challenge Henry's control. And as he showed in Richard III's circumstances, as soon as you start to sow doubt, people either stopped behaving in a certain way, they stopped offering their support, they stopped offering their money. They laid open all these opportunities for things to start crumbling. And that was what Henry was most fearful of, because he didn't come to the throne with this massive, solid group of experienced people who could command territorial control of vast areas of the country. It was very much a kind of household government court-based faction, which did develop that landed kind of experience for the Tudors. But the backers of Warbeck really did work out the best way to try and undermine the Tudor regime completely. So by picking off people who had these Yorkist credentials, getting them to go over to Margaret of York, who again was behind it, but the Emperor, but Maximilian Habsburg was also pulling the strings as the ruler of the Low Countries. He saw opportunities for sponsoring and destabilizing England for his own interests. So you can see how things got connected in a negative way for Henry, how he would have needed to start chopping these bits of the serpent off so they didn't all coil around him. He did a reasonable job. He was lucky in that the kind of household figureheads, so the steward and the chamberlain of his household, the people responsible for organizing the closest service to him in his chambers and rooms in the royal palaces, both ended up being executed for treason for involvement in these plots, Lord Fitzwalter and Sir William Stanley. Slightly different timings, So perhaps that gave him enough leeway to deal with both as separate cases. So Stanley certainly was the most dangerous, because after he'd been executed in 1485, they found about £8,000 in groat coins in his castle at Holt, enough to pay for in cash for an army of thousands for a couple of weeks, which was the normal campaigning time for a kind of army in the field. Whether that was true or not, a little bit of propaganda, I don't know. But clearly, it demonstrates the scale of the threat Henry faced by individuals, but also by the combination of these people who perhaps had uncertain allegiance to the Tudors, perhaps hadn't had the rewards they felt they deserved, had their heads turned by the possibility of Prince Richard being alive, because a lot of them had served him when he'd been with Edward V in the Marches of Wales in the 1470s. He was a known figure to them. Warbeck's impersonation of this character sowed all this doubt right across the Tudor politics. And Henry had to struggle for most of the 1490s to contain this. And it also spilled over into another tax rebellion and another need to go onto the battlefield in June 1497 at the Battle of Blackheath to contain another Western rebellion, which morphed into a regime change campaign as well. That took him through the first half of his reign pretty much in full defensive mode, firefighting mode against these recurring threats, not knowing where the next head of the Hydra is going to jump up from and how he then has to deal with it, because the dealing with it is very much in the circumstances of the people involved and the localities. And again, Henry's knowledge of how all of those things combined and came together was very much part of his solution to those immediate threats, but also to the longer term plan. So 1497-99, because obviously that Western Rebellion required an awful lot of resolving and sorting out, 1499 is a kind of the high point of the reign. He manages to capture Warbeck, get the Earl of Warwick trumped up as an ally to that treason, gets Margaret of Burgundy to confess, actually made up a lot of these allegations of survival, and then on the back of that, renegotiated or finalized the marriage for Prince Arthur and Catherine of Aragon to cement that alliance with the Spanish monarchs. So that seems as a high point, but by that stage, Henry's looking 20 years older than he actually was. He's grey from the effort. He's beginning to become ill every spring. I think he's really struggled to keep on top of these threats and still do the day job, which is running the country. So we see that 1499, 1502, he's much more like what you'd expect from a medieval king. He's doing more of the kingly things, marriages, hunting, acquiring nice things for his palaces, building Richmond Palace when Sheen Palace burns down in 1497. He's being more of a king, but then things start to degenerate again with more plots and pretenders coming towards the end of the reign, and then family problems with the death of Prince Arthur and then his wife, Elizabeth, by 1503. Create a whole different set of risks and dangers for the transfer of power. It gives you a real sense of how it wasn't an enjoyable job that he had. He really feels the need to preserve the family on the throne, to create this opportunity for the next heir. And he invests so much in Prince Arthur that he can't obviously take any account of the possibility that Arthur might not survive to become king. But the risk he takes, and perhaps that's the wrong thing to have done, because Henry, the second son, should have been given some developmental role in parallel to Arthur. I think Henry was perhaps slightly worried about creating blocks of power, as Edward IV had done in his reign. So Richard, as Duke of Gloucester in the 1470s, had run the whole of the north, basically. Duke of Clarence, early on in the 1470s, had run a lot of the West Midlands. So these power blocks create kind of mini kings in their regions. Henry was perhaps worried that he would do the same for Arthur and Henry, his sons, and that might have been an indication of possibility of civil conflict to come as they both scrambled around to try and get more power when Henry was gone. And that might explain why Henry, Prince of Wales, Henry VIII, when he's a young man, doesn't really get a profile beyond the court. He's a kind of creature of the court, kept close to the nursery and then to his mother until 1503. And obviously Prince Arthur is dead in spring of 1502. Henry's role suddenly has to change from being the spare heir to being the Prince of Wales, everything that entertained as responsibilities and hard effort to pick up those reins of future power, begin to learn how to be a king, but within a very narrow time frame. Because by then, Henry VII was already slightly less able to see himself on the throne for much longer than a decade, maybe. I think he was beginning to feel his mortality as a result of the shock of losing his son and his wife. the toll of all of that decade and a half of plotting and the shocks of losing people close to you, and a very human reaction and a very physical change that comes over Henry in his capacity to deal with this massive business he'd always managed to do, fingers on all of the strings of power, he has to then just step back a bit because he simply can't sustain that level of involvement.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Join us this month on Gone Medieval from History Hit. I'm Matt Lewis.
And I'm Eleanor Yonaga. This April, dive into our special miniseries.
With the help of leading experts, we're tracing the foundations of England by exploring the country's most powerful Anglo-Saxon kingdoms.
We'll be looking at Northumbria, Mercia, and Wessex, as well as the rulers and their councils who helped shape a nation.
Make sure to get every episode by listening and following Gone Medieval from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
I think it would be helpful to try and get some sense of how we should judge his monarchy, really, because people often talk about the way in which he controls noble families through using bonds and what are called reconnaissances and attainders. And perhaps you can tell us briefly what those are. But also historians discuss his gathering of money. And if you're going to be nimble and responding to threats, you need money at your disposal and you need it accessible. We also see, as you've mentioned, him acting architecturally, Richmond, the Lady Chapel at Westminster Abbey, and you've mentioned the treaty in order to marry Prince Arthur to the daughter of the Trastamara, the Isabel and Fernando of Spain, and just creating that sense of connections in Europe. If we scrutinise these aspects of his reign, how should we judge his monarchy, do you think?
I think this is a demonstration of his capacity to bring on board those great skills of statecraft, that he does recognise the need for these alliances and these changes to secure his position through strong finances. So it looks like it's a kind of more tedious interest because it's, again, it's a compensation for that early lack of experience. And he hangs on to that control longer than a lot of other kings did because they created a kind of architecture of government institutions that did a lot of this job for them. And they would drop in and out and know they had reliable people under him. I think the plotting always had that level of uncertainty, even within the household. All the people who'd worked for previous regimes could potentially just give up on their allegiance to the Tudors. So he sustained that connection to bureaucracy just so he could make sure that nothing visible was being done to undermine him through the generation of money, through the way that the law was applied or commissions investigated things. He had to be sure that people were working for him as well as for the stability of the state. So the personal monarchy and the ruling of the country become very much bound together because it's a little bit like Richard III towards the end of his reign, the threat he was under, and he makes that clear in some of the proclamations against Tudor. And Henry himself takes that a stage further and connects the government control to his personal status. And it means he can do some spectacular thing. He's making payments to the Philip of the Netherlands before they get shipwrecked and stranded at Windsor in 1506. He's making 30,000, 40,000 payments to safeguard Philip and Joanna's kind of rule in Castile when Isabella dies. So he's able to marshal these great sums of money out of the state that he's built. And it demonstrates your point about having the resources to put towards policy to secure not only a personal position, but to make a difference to how England is viewed. And after 1494, the French go into Italy, the Italian wars begin. Henry is floating around these leagues that the Pope is organizing. He never commits any English troops, but he might allow mercenaries to go, but he certainly is bankrolling a lot. And by the time you get to the Treaty of Cambrai, right at the end of his reign, he's very much involved in that high table of diplomacy, and people are waiting to hear of his kind of illness, whether he's going to be around for the next round of conflict. Even the King of France waits before the gate of Milan to hear if Henry's died in April 1509. By then, really makes a difference to how England is viewed as a player in diplomacy. So he's come from that obscure, no hope starting point to somebody that everybody wants to take account of, not just personally, but also for the way he's changed England. And I think people underestimate how important that kind of knowledge of government is. Kingship has to be about the personal links, the way the court functions, how you manage the household, how you project magnificence and behave and appear to be kingly and regal and magnificent, and all those things which everyone expects their ruler to have, because that generates the loyalty that you need. But the rest of that underneath that is relying on other people completely to discharge their responsibilities, to manage things on behalf of the king. And Henry knew from the disintegration of, say, the administration in France in the 1450s, right at the end of the Hundred Years' War, when the Duke of York and the Beauforts are basically squabbling over why England is losing its territory through bad government and the inability of the central administration to support the outliers of England's sort of first empire. Henry is a kind of victim of that to some extent, because the knock-on effect of that disintegration is Henry's weak kingship, the start of the Wars of the Roses, this 40 years of discord. So that weighs heavily on a king who's come out of that with the opportunity to resolve things. He really doesn't want to send any kind of signals that he'd be willing to slide back into conflict by taking his foot off the gas and allowing these overmighty subjects to come forward. Hence, certainly at the start of the reign, this it's not a program of bonds and reconnaissances, because these are tools which had been part of life in medieval government since the 13th century. So Llewellyn the Great takes a great big bond out in the 1260s against for Henry III to remain loyal. So they're tools which people know can have a really big impact on containing behavior because of the financial threat of forfeiture. I guess the problem for Henry is it begins to become a system of government. And how could he really call all of these bonds in, these fines, these suspended penalties, if he judged their conditions to have been broken? So a lot of the ones early in the reign are about allegiance, loyalty, good behavior. There's no financial exchange. It's all inherent in continuing in the timelines of what the king felt was acceptable. Later on, it flips into income generation in response to those dynastic calamities of losing his wife and son. He appoints a real set of brats to mechanically go through the processes to generate money. This is Empson and Dudley, Richard Empson, who'd managed a lot of the Duchy of Lancaster lands, who was a lawyer, and Edmund Dudley, who'd been an under-sheriff of London. He knew exactly how the London merchants worked and could unlock their wealth to the king. And it begins to become a way of raising money so the king doesn't have to go to Parliament asking for taxes. In fact, he doesn't call a Parliament after 1504. So Henry's kind of gone through this process of learning government, trying to apply it. And then when things go really off the rails in terms of family politics and the longevity, as it appears, of his family on the throne, he resorts to a very demanding, grasping, quite a ruthless way of ruling through people's purses, and begins to, as Polydor Virgil says, lightly fine those who would transgress. So he's basically creaming off some of the money to demonstrate the power of the reach of the crown, but is also being a little bit more arbitrary in tying people up in legalistic knots and using approvers and people ferreting out information which will result eventually after investigation into income forfeited to the crown. And this is a very bad way to rule the country, because it's not policy, it's hanging on to power And I think a lot of it is about getting Prince Henry to the age of 17, 18, giving him 5 years to learn the ropes of power, and then basically just shutting everything down, including Henry's kind of personal life, so that there is something to pass the crown to, which doesn't involve reopening the Book of Civil War and everybody else having a go to see if their rights can be pushed forward as Henry's were. But nevertheless, he's very conscious that the lid is just about kept on for most of his reign, but there's always somebody willing to knock him off the throne if he gives him that chance.
To close then, I want to talk about his legacy, because there's a sense in which, of course, he creates this dynasty that lasts for a century. But both in the immediate and the very long term, there seem deficiencies. The immediate is this sense that he hasn't really prepared Henry VIII for rule. And from my point of view, he appears relatively cruel to Catherine of Aragon. He seems practically to be a bully in those years in the early 16th century. And then, of course, there's political mileage for Henry VIII and the people around him in diminishing the reputation of his father after he becomes king. So there's that. And then also I'm fascinated by why the founder of the Tudor dynasty, who fights for his crown on the battlefield again and again, doesn't seem to have resonance in society today. Why don't we see him on the big screen? Why do we not have a kind of memory about him in the same way as we do his son?
Yeah, the fascinating question, because we do really, I guess, put a lot of these monarchs in this period onto a pedestal, which either shows good or bad characteristics and the effects that their personalities had on the country. And obviously Henry has a part to play in that, because he really did stop a period of civil war happening. He was under those threats for most of his reign. So it's a colourful period. If you get into the detail, you can see a constant struggle, a really dark and murky world of information exchange, a lot of spying, a lot of secret writing, a lot of actual second guessing of future manoeuvres, a lot of politics in the kind of conspiratorial sense, the king heavily involved in that with his close advisors to try and outthink his opponents, but also then outact them as well with the resources he's built. So he's got a very impressive way of bringing that personal need to bear with the machinery of government, with the resources of the state. And he does some really, as you say, ruthless and bullying things to almost cut out that consultation with the state. He's definitely ruling rather than governing with partners. So abandoning Parliament in 1504 for the last 5 years, a very dangerous thing to do, because it means he can't ask Parliament for taxation. So he's looking like he's closing down a traditional pillar of the way society functions under the king, in that very traditional medieval kind of feudal pyramid. But there's no sense of a general partnership government. It's the king and his close friends bullying their way through and using money as a threat to stop people doing things, literally by taking away their means to often just have a normal life. In its immediate aftermath, Prince Henry is still 17 when he becomes king. So he's young, he has very close friendships. He doesn't half like jousting. He certainly doesn't want to be doing the kind of things his father's done. And I guess he doesn't need to do that either, because Henry VII did all of the hard work in absorbing all this strands of government and all the way things had to be managed. Henry benefits from, to some extent, the treasure that's in the bank, in the royal coffers, and benefits from the relationships diplomatically that England has established. He's able to have this vision of the Hundred Years' War returning quite early in his reign. The glory of military leadership, Edward III, Henry V, are much more important to Prince Henry VIII. So his father has given him that platform through this kind of sacrificial working through the problems of civil war so that the next Tudor king can avoid those threats. And I know that they do come fairly regularly. And the stability of the marriage with Spain gradually crumbles as well. But I think, even if you see that, look at the personnel who are running Henry VIII's government for the first 4 years before Wolsey begins to assert his authority, it is council committees of Henry VII's old friends, the Earl of Surrey, Thomas Howard, Edward Poynings, Englefield, and the Earl of Shrewsbury. These are people who've been around for a lot of years, that kind of survived the gradual withering of Tudor's friends in the first reign. They're still there to guide the young prince, and he does rail against that somewhat, because they want to control and squeeze the direction of travel of government. So the immediate legacy is the young prince, who's now king, wants to have his own identity as king. He wants to put all those resources to the glories of warfare against Scotland or France. But that campaign begins to be fomented, put together quite quickly, even though it's 1513 before it's launched. So Henry VII's legacy is downplayed because those final 5 or 6 years of real harsh rule, on the one hand, everybody knows the king was connected to it. You can't deliver a policy to bureaucrats to run unless you endorse it and you're welcoming the benefits of the things they create. So Henry VIII can't say my father was horrible and didn't deserve to be king because he hasn't had a chance to prove himself yet. So that whole thing is played down and Empson and Dudley become the scapegoats for the whole range of fairly brutal policies. But you're right, you can see Henry's personality and the worry about the legacy he's passing on in that relationship with Catherine of Aragon and how the negotiations for the second marriage for Prince Henry are going. And again, it boils down to money and the dowry from Spain. You see him as a miser because he sees money as the root of flexibility in applying power and making policy and making those opportunities to change policy because you've got the resources to react and make the same difference, the change of direction. So I think it looks bureaucratic and miserly because of that reason. But we can see in the way Henry VIII benefited from that, that it was a really important thing to do in the context of the previous 40 or 50 years by 1509, because England's population had shrunk again. The kind of economic conditions hadn't been great until the 1480s. The Tudors have come along, brought the sweating sickness with them in 1485. There's lots of calamities which could have derailed the whole project fairly early on. But Henry VII kind of bullies his way through the early years. He then tries to be more subtle, and things look like they're heading quite well in a particular direction. But that all comes off the rail when Prince Arthur dies, and then Elizabeth of York dies in childbirth, or just after childbirth. As a consequence of that, Prince Henry then has to fill those boots. Henry VIII is looking back to see the horrors of early death and the risks that then throws up for a ruling family. He doesn't want to have to go through that. So this has a long shadow over Henry VIII's reign, his relationship with his brother, which doesn't really get talked about very much because they were physically separated, but there's a kind of link there and a legacy which Henry is at least trying to accommodate because he knows he was never the favoured son. He knows he was never developed and trained in the same way. So he bears that baggage. He bears his personal relationship with his father, the loss of his mother. Henry's legacy gets overshadowed by how Henry VIII works through that. And then the problems he has dynastically through the lack of a male heir till fairly late in his reign.
And that, of course, is another story. But it has been wonderful to talk about this founder of the Tudor dynasty and get a sense of both the scale of threat that he's having to overcome and actually the steepness of the learning curve for him to get that sort of intense level of focus on administration whilst also being willing to jump to the battlefield as necessary and the sort of person that he must have been before it all went wrong. Dr. Sean Cunningham, thank you so much. If people want to know more, of course, they should need to turn to your biography of Henry, which is simply called Henry the Seventh. But thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. It's been really enjoyable.
And thanks to you for listening to Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, and also to my researcher, Esther Arnott, and my producer, Rob Weinberg. We're always eager to hear from you, so do drop us a line at notjustthetudors@historyhit.com or on X, formerly known as Twitter, @NotJustTudors. And please remember to rate, rank, bestow multiple stars, and comment on this podcast wherever you listen, including on Spotify. It really helps more people find Not Just the Tudors. History is full of extraordinary people, the Tudors being just a handful. In my latest film on History Hit, we meet Bess of Hardwick and go inside the incredible house that she built, a house that defines the elegance and grandeur of the Elizabethan age, a house fit for a woman who climbed to the top of the Tudor social ladder. To find out more about the life of Bess and many more fascinating figures from the past, sign up via the link in the description with the code TUDORS for an exclusive discount.